Welcome to the Teaching Journeys podcast, hosted by Dave Roberts. Humanity possesses a unique skill, the ability to pass knowledge from one generation to the next. This podcast embraces that ability, offering learning opportunities through conversations with extraordinary guests. Dave aims to leave a positive mark on individuals around the world. So before you dive into today's episode, please share this podcast with your network, including friends, family, and colleagues. And please consider leaving a rating or review. Your support makes all the difference.
Hi, everyone, and welcome to another episode of the Teaching Journeys podcast. I'm your host, Dave Roberts. And today it is my pleasure to have as a return guest contributor on the podcast, John Turk. John Turk earned a PhD in organic chemistry in 1971 and was nominated by National Geographic as one of the top 10 adventurers of the year in 2012. Between these bookends, John co-authored the first college-level environmental science textbook in North America, followed by 30 additional texts in environmental, physical, and earth sciences. At the same time, he kayaked around Cape Horn and across the North Pacific from Japan to Alaska, mountain biked across the northern Gobi in Mongolia, and made numerous first ski descents and first rock climbing ascents around the globe. During extended travel in northeast Siberia, John's worldview was altered by Mulianat, a Siberian shaman, and his later books reflect these spiritual journeys. John has published four trade books called Oceans, In the Wake of the Zhoumen, The Raven's Gift, and Crocodiles and Ice. His newest project, Tracking Lion's Myth and Wilderness in Samburu, delves more deeply into a mind-body-spirit theme supported by adventure storytelling, integrated with an anthropological view of the role of art and mythology in human development. Welcome again to the Teaching Journeys podcast. I'm so excited to have you back as a guest contributor today.
Well, great, Dave. It's great to be back and to be talking with you, sitting around a campfire having a chat.
And with the chat's going to involve certainly the last book that you wrote, Tracking Lion's Myth and Wilderness in Samburu, and your work on Substack. And we're going to tie how all of this is kind of relating to what we're seeing in the world today. And perhaps with the two of us, we can maybe come up with some ideas in terms of what we can do to help get our country back on track. So,
well, the country really needs to be getting on track, and every little bit, hopefully, just is a little contribution we got to make.
You got it. So, but for those of my listeners who may have missed our first episode, beyond the bio, can you tell our audience who John Turk is?
Me? You want me to tell?
Yeah.
Well, like you said, I grew up as a chemist. I got my PhD in organic chemistry, but it just didn't fit. There was something missing in my life that was drawing me very strongly. So what was drawing me was wilderness. From a very earliest age, when I was a toddler and used to run away from home, in Brooklyn, I was 3 years old and could barely walk and run down to the end of the block and lose myself in the tall grass in a vacant lot, which I don't remember, but my mother would tell me. And finally, after all this schooling and all these years in the mass spec lab and all these studies, the calling of the wilderness, the calling of wild spaces, the calling of smelling the earth on a spring morning after the snow melts just was too strong. So I walked out of academic world. I walked out of research and started adventuring. But for a long time, I took the headspace of my Western upbringing into my adventuring. And it was all about succeeding, getting sponsors, making money, making a name for myself. And then in the year 2000, I ended up in this small village in Kamchatka. We were paddling kayaks from Japan to Alaska and met Mulianat, the old shaman. And I dropped my Western mindset and spent the next 5 years off and on in this little village, reorienting myself. And we talked about that in our last podcast. Mm-hmm. And now from that point on, the last 25 years, I've been moving on pretty much the same life, but with the wisdom that Moulinat tried to transfer to me.
Yeah, we spent our first podcast episode talking a lot about your book, The Raven's Gift. The healing that Moulinat promoted that basically had no basis in science, but just was real and just proved in the magic of the universe, which you have alluded to, I think, in several other talks. So, and actually, that's how I found that book. Found me in kind of like a general, I would call it like a general store setting in Colorado, and the title gravitated to me because of Raven and Crow and have. They've had specific teachings that have applied to my own life. And once I read about your journey, I just had to reach out to you. So that book found me at the opportune time. And of course, has led us to this present moment today as well, too. So
great. Thank you.
You're welcome. Now I want to get into the last book that you wrote, Tracking Lion's Myth and Wilderness in Samburu. What inspired your trip to Samburu, your journeys and your adventures in Samburu? What is the book about, and what do you want readers to take away from it, John?
Well, unusual travel suggestions are dancing lessons from God. That's a Kurt Vonnegut quote. And going to Samburu was a kind of a random thing. I was giving a talk at the Harvard Travelers Club, and a woman came up to me and asked me if I'd like to track lions in East Africa. And I said, yeah, man, yeah. There's no deepness there. It was just like, wow, that sounds fun. I'll track lions. But at the same time, I was working intellectually on this concept. I'd been doing a lot of anthropological research on what gave humans, Homo sapiens, 100,000 years ago, the cutting edge to survive.
Yep.
And I had given a talk for a TEDx talk called Big Brains, No Tools. And in that talk, the anthropological evidence is absolutely solid that as we grew big brains, actually, our survival decreased for a long time. The brains were more of a detriment than a help. And the turnaround was not tool technology, but art. And that just got to me that we have to rethink Western civilization and why we're here and what we're doing. And now I had a chance to go to East Africa near the Olduvai Gorge, near the beginnings, the origins of Homo sapiens. And not as a researcher, if I had been asking for an academic grant, I didn't have any solid A, B, C connect the dots. But I thought if I went to the origin of our humanity, our evolution, something might just pop up. So I said, yes, I'm coming. I'm on my way. I'll pack my bags.
You know, and I reading, and as I mentioned prior to recording, I haven't gotten through all of your book yet, but the first chapter got my attention when you were appeared to be in very hostile territory. You were with, I think, one of your guides, and he said, we got to get moving now. And I don't know if was it like that, where you were basically in a hostile environment and you had to negotiate that and rely on your survival skills and instinct to navigate that?
Well, yeah, this wasn't something I was bargaining for, but at the same time, it was part of the story that there was tribal warfare going on when I was there. And at first, it was in the background, and then it was all of a sudden became in the foreground. And there was people around getting shot. There were guns in camp. The head of the camp came to me and said, John, you live in Montana, don't you? And I said, yeah. And very casually, she said, just kind of curious, have you ever hunted? And I said, yeah, I've hunted. And she said, are you a pretty good shot? And I said, where's this conversation going? And she said, well, there's trouble in the neighborhood. There's more guns in camp than you know about. If the trouble gets really hot, can we count on you? And that changed the whole nature of the journey. And the chapter that you're talking about, I was camped up on the hill in a nice wall tent that tourists use and had amenities and everything. And my friend came up to me and said, we're moving camp. I said, when? He said, right now. And we went into this thicket down, lower down in the by the river, a very dense thicket, and it had newly been cut out with machetes. You could see the fresh machete cuts, and there was a little enclave in the middle of the thicket and maze-like paths around this thicket. And he said, you're camping here. And I went, okay, I got it. I've got to learn my way through this maze, and so on and so forth. So now we're talking in the book about tribalism.
Yep.
Part of the whole discussion of humanity's rise to civilization, rise to survival, because 70,000 years ago, Homo sapiens, us people, were almost extinct. And part of a very big part of our survival was related to tribalism, both good and bad. And now I was involved in tribal warfare, which is part of the story.
Yeah. What are the good and bad things about tribalism, and particularly, I think we can probably agree that we're seeing some elements of tribalism in today's society with the polarization we have on so many fronts. But what are the good and what are the bad things about tribalism that you see, John, from your experience?
Oh, boy, this is going to take a while. This is getting right to it, Dave. About 5 million years ago, humans, Homo sapiens, actually this was pre-Homo sapiens, our ancestors, our pre-Homo sapiens, other species, started growing big brains. Now, big brains have an advantage. We can think more, we can remember more, we can make more associations, we can hunt better, but they also have disadvantages. Brains take a tremendous amount of energy. We have to feed them. A brain at rest uses 13 times as much calories as a muscle at rest. So we're feeding that big brain. We have the ability to get more food, but we have to get more food. And our heads are ungainly up on our balanced on top of our skinny necks. We cause more death in childbirth with their big heads and so on. And because we're spending so much metabolic energy feeding our brains, our muscles got weaker. Don't ever get in a wrestling match with a chimpanzee. They will win.
Mm-hmm.
They will throw you to the ground. They're 10 times stronger than we are, bite your face off, and so on and so forth. We are very weak. We are very slow. So the trade-off of the big brain, we think, well, big brain is an advantage. Well, the trade-off, pluses and minuses, started turning against us. And by 70,000 years ago, there were only a few thousand Homo sapiens people left on Earth. Fewer, way fewer than the number of people that go watch a Taylor Swift concert or a football game or something like that. We were on the edge of survival, we were on the edge of extinction.
Yep.
And then there was a huge turnaround, and this is well established from DNA evidence, and all of a sudden the population started to explode. This is fact. What caused the explosion? Well, if you plot population against tool innovation, there's no correlation. We had a few tools 70,000 years ago, no sophisticated tools, no bow and arrows, no throwing tools. And our population explosion did not coincide with new tool technology. What it coincided with was art. So when people started creating art, they all of a sudden had a jump start on being able to survive. And why did art, that's something that's extraneous, that's not directly related to food gathering. In this tooth and claw world, you'd think that there would be a direct link between an innovation and our survival. It's an indirect link. And what was happening was, there was a few other things that were going on. We started to have camps, permanent camps.
Yep.
People were collected. A chimpanzees wander through the forest and eat fruit and don't have any permanent camps. But we had permanent camps. We had garbage dumps. And what that meant is that the tribe could consolidate in one place. Hunters could go out, gatherers could go out, grandparents could watch the kids. There could be a division of labor. There could be a tribe. And the tribe had very great strength.
Yes.
And the tribe was brought together in part by art. Art had the ability to bring people together around a common theme, sitting around the campfire, having a unity as a tribe. And this is what led to our survival. And next time somebody tells you, we have to cut art out of school because reading, writing, and arithmetic is important, and we have to cut religion out, and we have to cut all these extraneous things, because we have to sit down at our desk and get to work. Tell them, no.
Yeah, and John, I teach art students at the Pratt School of Art, or Pratt Munson School of Art in Utica, New York. I teach psychology courses, and their art basically just enriches me. I've got samples of that around my home, and I think art is the thing that can bring us all together. And I know you mentioned in your book, too, that the collective strength of the group of Homo sapiens became so much greater than the strength of each individual that the cost of creating the art and ritual was more than offset by the gain in terms of group cohesion, and that the group became stronger than the individual.
Totally, totally, Dave. We're totally on track here and in agreement. And there's a rule in anthropology that any cultural trait that's essentially universal has to have survival value.
Yep.
And every culture, before old, new, east, west, north, south, has art, has religion, has group, has concepts that brings group together, and that has survival value, as you just said.
Yeah.
Okay, so now the brain has, the human brain has two often conflicting directives that it goes in. One is the human brain, and this goes for most animals as well, has to be a predictive machine.
Yeah.
And what we do is from the very earliest days of infancy, we collect data about the environment, about our situation, and then we predict the future. So if a baby puts her hand on a candle and burns her fingers, that baby learns candles burn fingers, pain. And next time there's a candle, the baby doesn't touch it. And this has obvious advantage. Gray clouds mean rain. This type of environment or this season has this fruit. This season has this movement of animals. We learn from the environment, and we use that to predict the future in order to survive.
Yep.
Truth. Survival depends on accuracy.
Yes.
Okay? So if we predict that a certain fruit will be ripe at a certain time in a certain place, and we make an effort to go there, our survival depends on the accuracy of our predictions. Truth. Strength. Aha. But now here comes the problem. Fiction, not truth, lies, also have strength.
Yes, they do.
And here's how this came about. So we have a tribe, and there's another tribe over there and another tribe over there, and it's important to have cohesion in our tribe.
Mm-hmm.
And early art started to show that people were creating myth. So in one of the paintings in the caves in France, it shows a bison facing a man. The man is leaning back on his heels at a 45-degree angle. The man has a bird's head and is sporting a giant erection. Okay. Well, the artist knew that there were no men with bird's heads. And what the rest of it, there was a whole complicated scene, but what the erection was all about, we don't know. We don't know what the myth was, but we know that it was a myth. It was fiction, and the artist knew that. And every culture creates fiction. Our Lord was born from a virgin birth and then died, got resurrected, and went to heaven. Well, that's a myth, you see, and that's a unifying myth. And these myths unify the tribe. We believe in this, and therefore we're different, we're special, because you believe in something else. Now, if my myth is, hey, the sun rises in the east and sets in the west, well, that's not a very good myth. Because the other tribe over there might have the same myth. They might also think that the sun rises in the east and sets in the west. But now, let's say my myth is every night the crab and the crocodile have a big fight, and they fight for possession of the sun, and every day the crab wins, and then the sun comes up, and then the crocodile wins, and the sun goes down. Okay, that's fiction, right? But the power of the fiction is Our story is different from your story. We believe this, you believe that, and therefore we have unity. We're different than you. That pulls us together. That gives our tribe strength. But the trouble is that it allows some leaders who don't have everybody's best intentions in heart to make up a myth, and then we're going to believe it. I have the myth that vaccines don't work. Science, truth, has shown that vaccines have worked since Louis Pasteur. That was a long time ago. And all of a sudden, I'm creating a myth. The man is leaning back and has a bird's head and has a giant erection. Vaccines don't work. And that those myths tie us together and give the leaders power.
Yeah, and that's where polarization occurs, because the more a group buys into that specific myth with their specific tribe or group that they align with, that the more polarized they become and the more separate we become.
And that's the intention of the myth teller, to make us separate. The intention of those people who don't believe in this myth, you and me, and I hope all of our listeners, is to bring us together.
Yes. Yes.
So we have to fight that, and that's deeply embedded in our DNA. And I don't know exactly how to proceed except by doing what we're doing right now, is talking about this.
Yes. Now, that's a start. You know, we talk about and create some awareness and create education and maybe create a perspective that individuals can consider. They don't necessarily have to align with it, but at least it's food for thought. We're planting seeds and we're looking at some different perspectives to address the polarization we're seeing in our country today. So I wanted to talk a little bit about the role of storytelling in human development. I know you got into this, I believe it was in your book. You have remarked how stories have been our strengths and weakness, our path to survival and our path to destruction. And I think this will probably dovetail off of what we've already talked about. But how does that apply to what we're seeing today in the world?
Well, polarization is tribalism. And what's coming out, excuse me, out of Washington, I don't want to get political, but what's coming out is beyond any kind of reason, beyond any kind of logic. If we go back to the first concept of our brain, predictiveness, following truth, gives us the path to finding bananas. And we take away that truth, it leads us, there has to be a balance, man. I mean,
yes,
there is tribalism, and I mean, I live in a community in the woods in Montana, and most of us have known each other for 30 or 40 or 50 years. We're in a sense a tribe, but our tribe doesn't need mythologies to hold us together. There are other things, other factors that hold us together. We all like to ride bikes. We all like to hike. We all like to grow gardens. We have things that will hold us together and give us a commonality. And so tribalism, we don't want to, we can't get rid of tribalism. We want to have our tribes. We want to have our friends. But the storytelling, sitting around a campfire and telling stories, is a wonderful thing. Creating the story, twisting it to, I mean, here's an example that happened in history. Napoleon Bonaparte, Napoleon, was with a group of people who were trying scientifically oriented, and he twisted their science into a story and said, let's go march on Russia. And a million soldiers grabbed guns and went to march to Russia.
What?
I get carried away. Excuse me, Dave.
That's it. Hey, this is your platform, man. So you can get as carried away as you want on the podcast. So,
okay. Yes.
One of the things I love about you is your passion for what you believe in and what you've researched. And so you have an open invitation to come back anytime. So, so I wanted to talk to you as well about the reference in your book to Eric Vance and his book, The Suggestible You, The Curious Science of Your Brain's Ability to Deceive, Transform, and Heal. Vance alludes to the brain as an expectation machine, that it builds a repertoire of experiences and past events to predict what will occur in the future. Relying on expectation is much faster than analyzing each situation independently. And John, why this struck me as much is, you know, I've been given a lot of thought very recently to the lack of what appears to be critical thinking in our society now, given the current state of affairs. Does Vance's belief of that we're relying on expectation, does that inhibit our ability to think critically?
Oh, boy, that's a really good question. You're hitting right at the heart of it, Dave. Yeah, the expectation machine, as we've been talking about, leads us to, as you said, shortcut the thought process. So let's think of something really simple. In the savannah, 70,000 years ago, lions and leopards ate people. So people had a survival incentive to run away when they saw a lion in the bushes.
Yep.
So now you see a flash of motion in the bushes. Just a movement. Kind of tan colored and everything. Well, you can stay there and analyze it and figure it out. Was that a lion? Was not a lion? Think about it, so on and so forth. Or you can run away. And your expectation machine is, there's a pretty good probability or a reasonable probability that's a lion, so I'm going to be safe and run away. And this gives you survival. So the expectation machine gives you survival value. And you can shortcut the process. But now this can be subverted. The autocrat, the dictator, the king, the would-be king, gives you a set of rules and false expectations, fictions, to make you stop thinking and agree with the dictator. So at one point, seeing the flash of motion in the bushes, by stopping thinking, you run away sooner and you have a better chance of survival. But now the king, the would-be dictator, gives you a set of mythologies. Like I said earlier, vaccines are no good. Now we don't have to think. We don't have to go and read about Louis Pasteur and go back to our old science books and so on. We're just handed this package of mythologies, and now we've lost our ability to critically think. And that's where the trouble starts.
And, you know, the other thing with critical thinking, it requires us to make an investment where we're taking a look at the narratives that we've bought into based on our experiences. And that can be scary for a lot of people because it involves Am I willing to change what I believe or expand on what I believe? I think that prospect of change is also very scary to a lot of individuals, which is why their behavior is dictated by expectations that's based on myth. I don't know if that's something you've experienced in your travels or in talking to other individuals, but that's something that with the clients I worked with in the past, and particularly if they've come from families, unhealthy families that have spanned generations and generations, those same myths are passed down from generation to generation without altering the genetic code and automatically followed without thought by the future generations that have come from unhealthy family dynamics. So
there's a famous psychology experiment. You have a group of people, and let's say you have 8 people. 7 of them are actors, and 1 of them is the subject being checked on. And the psychologist knows that the 7 are actors, only 1 is the subject. And the psychologist goes like this: how many fingers am I holding up? And the first person says 3, 3, 3, 3. And then the subject looks at the 4 fingers, looks around at the room, and I don't remember the exact numbers, but a high percentage of subjects will say 3.
Wow.
When there's 4 fingers up there.
Yeah.
And the subject is so afraid of social embarrassment that will take an obvious counting, 1, 2, 3, 4, which everybody knows how to do, and change it to be in with the group.
Yeah.
So you have that going on in the news every day.
Mm-hmm.
It's, I decide that I'm in group A. And now if everybody in group A says vaccines are bad, how many fingers am I holding up? Vaccines are bad. And that's what's going on. And it's essential, I think, to remember this experiment. How many fingers am I holding up? 4. I don't care if everybody else says 3. I'm saying 4 because I can count.
Yes.
And it's essential that every one of us take a little bit of time to read. I'm retired. I have no children. If I had a job, a 2-hour commute, kids to take to gymnastics, I wouldn't have as much time to read as I do. So this is a problem. But it's important to understand this dichotomy between the brain's necessity for information, for facts, so we can find the bananas, and the brain's tendency to join the group and to separate those. We want to be with our group. We want to be with our friends. And at the same time, we have to stick with the facts, 1, 2, 3, 4. And that's what each of us has to struggle with in our own lives and be aware mm-hmm. of.
And if the facts that we know to be true don't align with the prevailing group mentality, we have to have the courage to stand up and say, no, this is, I don't have 3 fingers up, you have 4 fingers up. And again, present that as an opportunity, perhaps for growth for the group, to take a look at their own internal dynamics and see what they can do to improve that.
Thank you, Dave. Yes, exactly.
I want to talk a little bit about your Substack. I know one of the last times we talked, you were considering doing Substack, and obviously you made the jump, and you've been writing a lot of good posts, good articles, good blog posts. some that I saw that kind of alluded to your past experiences with Mulianat, others that have kind of been, I think, an extension of tracking lines and myth. The first blog that you wrote, your introductory blog, you talked about viewing current events from a Paleolithic perspective and from the deep wild. What can we learn from both the Neolithic and Paleolithic eras that can help us find unity in a pretty polarized world right now? And also, what can we learn from the birds, the animals that can help us create an atmosphere where unity can be achieved?
You ask good questions.
Thank you, John.
The nature doesn't lie. Nature isn't for us or against us. Nature just is. When we are in nature, in order to be out there, we have to be present.
Yes.
And I gave some, I used to give some workshops, presence workshops, and I was never, ever, ever happy with any of the workshops I gave. And I would take people for a day out into nature and say, okay, now let's try to be present. Oh, I hated that. Oh, we have to work at it. Oh,
yeah.
I know for a fact that if you or you or you or you got in a canoe with me and we had a certain amount of food and we had a river to go down and we were going to be in that canoe for 3 weeks, I know that nature would teach you, without my saying anything, without you trying, would teach you presence.
Yes.
And the more time we spend in nature, the more time, the more opportunity nature has to just come into us. And so, you go to town and you go, okay, now I got to remember I need a 5/64 inch drill bit because I broke my bit. You go out in the woods and you don't think any of that stuff. You're just thinking, I was out in the woods today. We have a trail behind the house. We live in the forest, big forest. It's 100 miles in one direction to the nearest paved road and all that. And we have trails behind our house that I built over the last 40 years. And a tree blew down and blocked one of the trails. So I went out today, this morning before the podcast, to clear the tree and open up the trail again. And it's fall and the huckleberry plants are turning red. And I decided to take a little shortcut because I was carrying a heavy chainsaw and I didn't feel like following the trail. And I was, oh, this is a little different. But I was carrying a chainsaw and I had to not get hurt and not trip. And your mind just centers, and it's the truth and predictive part and not the tribal part. And you, all of this people business, you know, it's a lot of work to hang around people. We have to know, we have to have theory of mind to know what they're thinking and not worry about them and everything. So this is one way to center ourselves. It's not the only way. If you're an oboe player, you can reach that same presence playing the oboe. I'm not an oboe player, so I teach wilderness presence. It's one way to get there.
And you know, it would be really cool as if we kind of made a commitment globally as a society where we were going to go out in nature with somebody who had different beliefs than us, spend time with them, and then have a conversation after we've had the opportunity to have nature wash over us and see where that goes. We might find some commonality amidst the difference. Who knows?
Yeah, and we might not talk politics.
Yeah.
I live in the woods in a reasonably remote place in Montana, and our road is a common road. It's not maintained by the county. And when things happen to the road, we all get our shovels and pickaxes and chainsaws and whatever it is and fix the road. And I know that some of my neighbors are radical Republicans, and I know that some of my neighbors are radical Democrats. But at the same time, if the culvert overflows and tears up the road, we won't be able to get to town. Mm-hmm. So we have to go clear the culvert.
Yeah, regardless of ideology, regardless of political beliefs, we all have to pull together to ensure safety, to ensure that our infrastructure is sound so that the rest of our neighborhood can continue to function as they normally would.
And I think if we stop using the word government and start using the word neighborhood, maybe that would be a first start. We have to keep our neighborhood functional.
Yep. A change in verbiage. Maybe you can look, have a change of perspective. And I think the willingness for all of us, regardless of ideology, to sit down around a campfire and just have a conversation and maybe find some common ground through what nature teaches us or through what maybe our other shared values may be. And, maybe we will become more unified amongst the differences that we're always going to have with each other.
Thank you.
You're welcome, John. I'm wearing my crow t-shirt for the podcast in honor of Kutka, the raven god, and in terms of what Kutka has meant to both of us. But one of the things that I've learned in terms of just watching crows and ravens is that they're very adaptable. They take what the earth gives them. It doesn't matter if it's roadkill. It doesn't matter if it's grain. It doesn't matter if it's vegetation. They adapt. And I think we can learn as human beings about the importance of adaptability, to take what the earth gives us and to be able to work with that. That's one of the things that, in addition to watching crows who will attack birds that are, hawks, owls that are bigger than them just to protect their territory, they also teach us to overcome our fear. Maybe we could take a look at some crow energy, some crow teachings, incorporating that in our life to get rid of the fear of talking to somebody else with different ideologies so that we can embrace what the common ground that we do share. So who knows? Maybe that'll happen.
I like the word adapt, because the word adapt, which you used several times just in the last little bit, is different than convert.
Yes.
The humans, if the environment isn't exactly to their likings, they like to convert the environment to my liking. And the animals adapt to the environment instead of convert it. And if we start doing a lot more adapting and less heavy-handed conversion, we'd be way ahead of the game.
Yeah, it's adapting and working in harmony with nature and harmony with our natural resources. That's going to be the key to our continued sustenance, I think.
Yeah.
John, as always, you leave us with so much wisdom and teachings from your experiences, but I'm going to ask you a couple of last questions. The first, if you could give our audience one ultimate takeaway for today, what would that be?
One piece of wisdom?
One piece of wisdom. And it could be, there could be subcategories too with this, John. So.
Oh, it's all about present state.
It's,
I mean, that's not a John Turkism. That's been around for a long, long time. But it's all about living in the moment. And it's all very Buddhist. It's been said before that, how does it go? Yeah, bad things can happen to me, but suffering is my choice. Mm-hmm. And you can choose not to suffer. You can choose not to get aggravated. You can live in the present. That's not new. It's been around for a while.
Yeah, that's probably been around since the indigenous tribes formed. I mean, that being present, being still, and being mindful. But it isn't new, but it's relevant because in this day and age, with technology, with other distractions in society and just day-to-day living, it's very hard to be focused in the present. It's always like, what do I got to do next? Or so it's like I said, it's something that's been around for a long time, but sometimes as simple as the things that have been around for a long time are the hardest things to practice. So.
Yeah. And anger isn't working. You have to look at, we just have to chill, man.
Yeah. We got to chill. And control what we can control, and I think if we can conduct ourselves with love, compassion. I look at Ram Dass, who talks about the way of social action. It's all about doing social action with a compassionate heart, with trying to foster a greater understanding among those who have differences with us, and that's what it's about. Love and compassion and presence are going to get us through this time, and not anger. Not division, not isolation, not tribalism. It's going to be love and compassion that are going to rule, make the world a better place.
Thank you.
You're welcome. And John, with that, I'm going to give you a chance to promote yourself a little bit. How can people purchase your book, your books, The Raven's Gift, and also Tracking Lines of Myth and Wilderness in Sambaru? Just find out more about your what you're doing. Also, subscribe to your Substack. What's the best way for them to do that?
Yeah, well, there's my website, johnturk.net, www.johnturk.net. My books are for sale everywhere books are sold. And I sell them over my website as well. My Substack is just go to Substack and search for John Turk, and you'll come right into it. I post about once a week, and many of the things that we're talking about now, I'm having a real fun time doing the Substack because it's writing a book a week at a time, and I get a whole week. If I'm writing a book, I'm like under a deadline, and I gotta turn out a certain number of words. Here I can think about the next 300, 400, 500 words for a whole week and then write it. And I'm really enjoying my Substack and getting good, favorable comments and followers. So just go to Substack, John Turk. Go to my website, johnturk.net, and send me an email, and we'll have a chat. Sounds great. Thank you, Dave.
You're welcome, John. And I'll make sure all of your contact information gets in the episode notes. And with that, thanks again for a wonderful conversation, and I hope we can do this again in the future.
Okay, great. I enjoy your company, so thank you very much.
You're welcome. And with that is a wrap on another episode of the Teaching Journeys podcast. I'm your host, Dave Roberts, wishing you peace.